Well, good evening and welcome to the latest live stream event. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here on the 15th of September 2020. Great to have you on board, and thanks very much for taking some time out of your Tuesday to spend it with me and the community here. It's great to see you there. We've got nearly 350 on already, which is good, and hopefully that'll climb over the next few moments. Lot to talk about tonight, so much going on, so many different topics to explore, and obviously the centre of the conversation will be the latest household financial confidence data, but a few other things I want to cover as well. So I'm just going to start by going through a few slides. As normal, during this part of the show, I'm not going to be looking at the chat, so if you've got a question for me, hold off and ask it a little bit later, but there's just a few things I want to cover first. So as normal, we'll just start with the running order, which is this introduction, the house rules, about our models just briefly, some key slides. We'll spend about 20 minutes on those, and then questions and answers, and hopefully we'll sign off around 9:30, maybe a bit before, depending on how many questions we get and whether we exhaust ourselves. And just as normal, the house rules, just to be clear, this is not financial advice. I'm not qualified to give financial advice. I don't know your individual circumstances. So it's really important you understand this is just my data and my analysis. It's quite detailed, quite thorough, but it is not the same as financial advice. If you need financial advice, go find a financial advisor. Please play nice in the chat room. Plexus, once again, is doing a masterful job in terms of moderating. Thanks, Plexus. Really appreciate your support. Please, no racial slurs. We don't need those. Do encourage conversation in the chat, on topic and off topic, so feel free to participate there. There's always plenty going on. I won't necessarily follow all the sub-themes. And, of course, this is as at the 15th of September 2020, if you're watching this show down the track. Please use @WalkTheWorld to get my attention. There's always so much activity on the chat that it's almost impossible for me to follow everything, but I do look out for @WalkTheWorld, so use that if you want to pose a question for me. As I say, I'll be looking at that after the presentation section. I've enabled Super Chat, and that does two things. One is it allows you to make sure that your question goes to the top of the queue if you want to do that. And also it gives you a way of very simply making a contribution to DFA to help us cover the costs of what we do. DFA is essentially not set up to make profits. It's basically just covering its costs. So any contribution goes directly back into making more content. Now, just in terms of the model, for those who have not been here before, it's very important to understand that the basis of our analysis is on not just opinion, but fact. And those facts come from our household survey. So we survey 52,000 households over the year, 4,700 each month, 1,000 a week, in fact, on average. And we pull information from those, also our SME survey, and we also have some other information sources too, as well as information from all the traditional places like the Reserve Bank and APRA and everybody else, plus information from the public disclosures of all the companies we follow. That goes into the core market model, and that then drives information out to our industry reports, to things like the blog, and also, of course, custom conversations. So I'll mention later the DFA one-to-one conversations where I discuss an individual postcode with people. We're doing quite a lot of those. Very interesting conversations. I've learned a lot as well, and hopefully people have found that quite useful too. Now, as well as that, we can slice and dice the data all different ways, and that allows us then to understand the mix of households, location, segment, even property status, and that's quite valuable in terms of understanding what's going on. We also run some scenarios based off the back of that, and those scenarios obviously help us to understand what's going on, and we'll touch on those. I haven't made a fantastic difference to the scenarios this time around. Things have pretty much played out precisely as I expected, so we won't be touching on the scenarios much tonight, but the scenarios are important because what it underscores is that it's difficult to be absolutely definitive. There are so many variables, so I have a range of different scenarios and outputs. And one of the reasons why, you know, people keep quoting 40% in a year or whatever, that's never been on my radar at all, despite what the media may be reporting. And it's also worth just saying that because of that, we can take our mortgage stress data, our price trajectory and history, the buying and selling intentions, the migration statistics, and the economic data, things like CPI, wages and employment. We can bang that into the core market model through our scenarios. And then we can look at that at a postcode level, roll it up for region, state, and the whole or Australia. But that allows us then to look at the trajectory of prices, home prices in particular, and those then power our more detailed analysis. So it's very much a bottom-up piece of analysis. We actually have information at pretty much every postcode across Australia. Now let's just go to the RBA minutes. One of the interesting things about the RBA minutes was that, of course, they didn't make any change to the underlying rate, but there were some interesting comments. The first one I found fascinating because they drew a comparison between China and most advanced economies. So China, they said, they're putting stimulus in to support businesses and to stimulate investment, which is really interesting. Whereas in advanced economies, household income transfer is featured much more prominently and supporting household disposable income and consumption to a greater extent than the production side of things. So there is a difference of channel in terms of what's happening in China with regard to what's happening in other Western countries. I think that's quite fascinating. It's the first time the Reserve Bank has drawn that out. The second point they made, though, was that despite the support for household disposable income and consumption, household consumption has contracted significantly in the June quarter, with the decline being particularly steep. Consumption has started to recover, but is still well below pre-pandemic levels. And then they go on to say, and of course, with the Victorian lockdown, that's also another negative factor. Then they went on to talk about home prices. They said prices for established dwellings in Melbourne and to Sydney have declined in recent months, mixed elsewhere. And so far, the decline in established housing prices has been less than those 2 years earlier. We'll talk about that a bit later as well. Meanwhile, rental markets remain weak. Rental supply has been boosted by short-term and holiday rentals brought into the long-term rental markets. That's Airbnbs and those sorts of things. Demand has been depressed by a reduced flow of new migrants and the decline in the rate of household formation. Therefore, rental vacancy rates have risen recently, and there is downward pressure on rents, and that's unlikely to dissipate in the near term in either Sydney or Melbourne. Now, of course, those are the two big investment markets, so that's a very strong negative signal for property investors. Also, they observed that the 1.8% increase in the wage price index over the year to June was the lowest growth in the history of the series, so don't hold out your breath for wage rises anytime soon. And then they went on to talk about banks' funding costs. And this was quite a long conversation. I'm not going to go through it all, but there were some very interesting points there about the fact that essentially banks now are able to get more facilities from the Term Funding Facility, the TFF, which is essentially a very low-cost route provided by the Reserve Bank. And as a result of that, and the inflow and deposits, which is another relatively low-cost source of funding, it means that there has been a decline in bank bonds issued in the year, and a specifically less reliance on bonds issued offshore. So in other words, the Reserve Bank is effectively shoring up its position as the prime funder for our banking system in Australia, which I find really fascinating. And it also, of course, gives them more control, because whilst they continue to determine the interest rate at a very low level, what it means is that they can guarantee pretty much low interest rates out along the yield curve for as long as they want. And that, of course, is all about trying to stimulate more borrowing. The trouble I see is that it's not a matter of borrowing growing because there's no funding. Borrowing isn't growing particularly fast because businesses and households are less able and willing to commit, and that's a different problem, and I'm not sure that cheaper funding necessarily solves it. Now, the other interesting observation today was from APRA and ASIC. They signed an updated Memorandum of Understanding, and they basically have committed to increase their engagement. Well, some would say we should just bang APRA and the ACCC together to see whether we can actually make things simpler. But what's fascinating about this, what's really fascinating about this, is that there is an understanding that as well as financial stability, we have to consider competition in the marketplace, right? And that's really fascinating because up till now, APRA has tended to argue for a very small number of very large institutions as being the best way to guarantee financial stability, whereas ACCC has been arguing very strongly for greater competitive dynamic in the financial system. So it's interesting that they're trying to pull these two together. And in fact, there are a series of MOUs between APRA and ACCC, APRA and ABS, APRA and ASIC. And all of this is trying to sort of patch up what I think is probably one of the most significant risk issues that we have in the country. And that is that all these regulators have a bit of the puzzle, but nobody has all of the puzzle. So the real issue we have is that they're all sort of looking after a little piece of the financial system or the financial markets or the competitive landscape. And they're all now sort of trying to sort of juggle the pieces together. I think there's a very significant argument for blowing up all these regulators and trying again, because I don't think the regulatory environment in Australia has served us at all well. And just to give you an example of that, the reforms that came out of the back of the Royal Commission 2.5 years ago or so are still stuck. The bank lobbied very hard to stop those coming in. And so even things like some of the broker legislation is stuck. So we haven't seen a lot of the reforms that came out of the back of the Royal Commission 2.5 years later. And of course, now everyone's using the COVID as an excuse as to why not to do it, which is, I think, a bit shameful. So that's another reason why I think the regulatory framework needs to be thought through rather differently. And they talked about complementarity, right? We continue to build relationships, constructive relationships. I'm afraid that's all lip service as far as I can see. Let's see the results, mate. Let's see the results. Now, Deloitte also came out today with a rather significant report, and they've basically backed the concept of extending JobSeeker. So they argue that if you take JobSeeker down to where it was before the COVID, you're going to lose $31.3 billion in gross domestic product, and also see higher unemployment. And the argument that they put is that money going to those people on JobSeeker is more likely to be spent, and therefore it's a higher significant spending into the economy and a lot of leverage into the economy. And it's also worth noting that Australia has essentially one of the lowest support mechanisms in any country in the world. And that's another reason why I think probably taking it back to where it was previously, back to the old bootstrap theory. In other words, people need to get off JobSeeker and get into work. I think that's a bit of an old-fashioned set of arguments. So it is interesting that there's quite an alignment now of people saying, no, we can't go back to where we were previously. And of course, JobSeeker ratchets down again at the end of the year. Maybe there was something in the budget. I hope there is, because I think we need a different strategy, personally. Now, in terms of property, CoreLogic says that property listings are down. And in fact, Cookie Boy also posted today that even the other REA and Domain also showed that listings were down. This is actually the CoreLogic series. And interestingly, the a big area, of course, is a drop in Melbourne. So it's down 77.4%. And that's the 12-month change in terms of number of new listings. And the total number of listings are down 31.2% over 12 months. But it's interesting that Adelaide and Perth and Darwin and Canberra are all significantly down. Sydney is holding up a bit more. So there's very little change in listings in Sydney, which suggests that perhaps Sydney is becoming a rather different market from some of the others. But overall, down 20% over 12 months, or in terms of the number of new listings, down 23.9%. So lower volumes, and of course that's hitting a lot of real estate agents who are getting less sales as a result, and more real estate agents are actually on JobKeeper than previously, I've noticed in some of my data. Auction clearance rates are still low. This is SQM data. So the Sydney auction clearance rate, the real rate, was a 51.8%. Ignore some of the other reporting. It just is not calculated correctly. Melbourne at 10%. Brisbane at at 10%, none in Perth, Adelaide at 30, Canberra 82.4. Yeah, Canberra is still quite a hot market in terms of auctions. Darwin 50-50 or just over, and nothing in much in Hobart. And it's also worth just highlighting the fact that they call out what's been re-advertised for private treaty or rescheduled, and there's a considerable proportion that actually go down that route. And there are also some sold prior to auction. So I think the SQM data is the most robust in terms of understanding what's going on with regard to auction clearances, but don't believe all the stuff you read in the portals and indeed in some of the newspapers when they quote those very high levels of clearances on a partial set of information. SQM's doing a great job on this, I think, now. Now, next thing to talk about briefly is the ABS. So ABS reported their price data to June today, and overall it dropped 1.8%. You can see that here. We had effectively three quarters of rises. The peak was about 4% a couple of quarters ago. But this is really interesting. They basically called out the fact that COVID-19 saw residential property transactions fall substantially. This reduced the number of transactions in most strata. Stratification methods required a sufficient number of transactions to compile the indices each quarter. So to overcome this, the ABS introduced imputation methods. Now, this is really important. What they're saying is there is not enough volume in some areas to be able to directly read what's happening to prices. And of course, this is the whole question about market discovery, as we or price discovery, as we discussed last week with Tony, that effectively with really low volumes, it's very hard to get a good read on what prices are really doing. And they talked about essentially two methods: the donor imputation, where the number of residential property transactions are extremely low, and they look for donor series available. And this approach takes price movement from a donor series, such as another stratum, dwelling type, or city, for example, imputing a movement in the Hobart attached dwellings price index from the movement in the Hobart's house price index. And the other one is mean imputation, which is essentially where the number of residential property transactions are extremely low, and that derives the strata movement using the average, the mean price movement of all other strata. And so an example would be Brisbane house price index using the average price movement for other strata and the house price index for Brisbane. The reason I've gone through this in some detail is not because I believe the particular method is appropriate, but what I'm trying to underscore is all of these indices, all of these measurements of house price movements are based on a set of assumptions and theories about how to do it. And they are not direct reads of what's going on in the marketplace. And that's an important point to understand when you look at the more granular information. So, for example, here, this is the information for the major cities. And you can see there that in Sydney, there was a 2.2% fall. In Melbourne, 2.3%. Small falls in Brisbane, Adelaide, and in Perth. A small rise in Canberra, 0.8. And an average of down 1.8. And the other point to make is that the imputation methods that they used was actually for these two, for Hobart and Darwin. They had to use imputation methods because the information was just incomplete. And the other point is quite interesting, that the total value of Australian property at 10.5 million residential dwellings fell by 98.2 billion to 7,138.2 billion in the June quarter. And Hobart and Darwin, as I say, were actually using donor imputation to try and get to the information. So again, it's not completely clean. Now, in terms of the business survey information, this is quite interesting. This is from the Australian Chamber and Westpac today. And they basically called out that manufacturing sentiment has been shaken by the COVID crisis. There was the initial restrictions and lockdown, and then the second wave in Victoria. During the September quarter, a net 18% of respondents expect the general business situation to worsen over the next 6 months. That's only a slight improvement in the June reading, a shift of 4%. And this is likely, they say, to the high degree of uncertainty about future lockdown restrictions and the challenging environment more generally. That is consistent with my own survey information, which shows that many businesses are really struggling, particularly small businesses, and about one third doubt whether they'll be in existence in about 6 months' time. Now, of course, it's very difficult to predict that, but that's a very important point. Business investment is very low. Now, remember what I said about China? That there in China, according to the Reserve Bank, China is backing its businesses with investment in the business sector. In Australia, we're not. There is not the right level of support to help the business community, particularly small business, through this situation, in my view. And it's my very strong opinion that this is a major policy mistake. I hope they turn it around in the budget next month. I'm not sure they will, but it's small business that we need to support. It's small business which is essentially the economic engine of Australia, not the big end of town where a lot of the JobKeeper payments went. Small business is where it needs to go to. I think that's a really important message for tonight. And then we look also at consumer confidence, and this is the latest Roy Morgan, and it basically says that consumer confidence is still near GFC lows. So this is essentially the GFC. This is where we are now. And they did actually say consumer confidence rose for the second week. It was weaker in Melbourne, though, dropping more than 5% from the prior week. And of course, the announcement of longer paths to lockdown is partly to blame there. Confidence was also, though, weaker in Sydney, dropping more than 3% from the previous week. And that's something I'm seeing as well, specifically that Sydney and Melbourne are all looking pretty wobbly. There are actually higher levels of confidence in regional Victoria and actually above the neutral level in Perth. So maybe those border controls and restrictions are helping Western Australia. Now, interestingly, the time to buy a major household item was up a little bit. And they said, to close out this discussion, that in the October budget, they'll be watching for signs that talk about tax cuts and job creation measures may impact consumer confidence. I suspect that the tax cuts will do very little help, but I could be wrong. Now, let me just remind you again that the stimulus cliff remains. So this is from UBS. In the third quarter, it was more than 20% of GDP. In this quarter, it's sitting at about 7.5%. In the next quarter, it's just over 2%. And so whatever else is going on, we know that ahead, support is being withdrawn. And this is another way of showing the same information. This is basically from news.com and from Alpha Beta. And this is an interesting chart because it shows you that since the start of the crisis, $14.2 billion was lost in wages, $2.8 billion was lost from unincorporated businesses' income, and then we've got $4.9 billion for economic support payments, $7.4 billion for job seeker, $6.6 billion for job keeper, $19 billion for early super, $3 billion for mortgage deferrals. And so the net cash flow at the moment, with $17 billion lost, and $41 billion gain is positive $23.9 billion. But go back to that previous chart, and you can see that next quarter, a lot of that disappears. And this is the real issue with regard to what's going to happen ahead. Now, of course, the mortgage deferrals is only about $3 billion. It's not massive, right? There's been a lot of focus on mortgage deferrals. That's not the major leverage point. Actually, the superannuation was probably the biggest. And that's one of the reasons why savings ratios have improved, plus JobKeeper and JobSeeker. But we know that JobSeeker and JobKeeper are actually now being scaled back. We know that superannuation withdrawals are going to a crawl now. And we know that mortgage deferrals are reversing. So essentially, my question is, how is that gap going to be filled? And Westpac's CEO Peter King confirmed on Friday that some of their customers we're now in strife. Remember, we've got 450,000 Aussies potentially receiving calls from the bank saying what you're going to do. And of course, some of those are also small business customers too. And about something like 19% of small businesses are affected by this. This is a really big deal. Now, last time I just revealed the mortgage stress data, and just to highlight it, of course, it's up at 40.1%. Mortgage stress, despite all that stimulus, despite what I've shown above, it's not necessarily just supporting those with mortgage flow issues. But today I want to go into the financial confidence index, which is the other part of the survey. And this is the latest data relating to the confidence index. So essentially you can see there that the confidence has bounced back just a little. It was last month down, now up to 76.5. So that's a bit of an improvement. But It's also worth noting that it's not uniformly spread. This is actually what happens when you look at by segments. So essentially, the free affluent segment, that without a mortgage, those with property but no mortgage, are actually a little improved, still below the baseline 100, but improved. Those who are renting are slightly less positive, and that's to do with the cash flows relating to their income more than anything else. Rents are a little bit lower, but they've still got significant issues. And then the mortgage cadre, whether that's investment or owner-occupied, is just down slightly. So it depends where you are. I also make the point that those free affluents tend to be more exposed to stock markets, which are doing quite well at the moment. That's partly why that's happening. Now, we can also look across the states, and that's quite an interesting story too. So we can see that in New South Wales, the confidence actually moved up very, very slightly, but, you know, frankly, hardly enough to notice. Whereas in Victoria, it dropped substantially more over the last month. And that's consistent with what the other research is showing from other sources. Whereas in Queensland, there was a slight improvement. In South Australia, there was a slight improvement. And in Western Australia, there was a more significant improvement. We are seeing something quite interesting. WA is beginning to look quite perky about what's going on, which is quite interesting. Now, of course, that may partly be to do with the fact that the iron ore is still going offshore and hitting the Chinese market quite well. But I think it's broader than that. Although I did notice that there's still more pressure on home prices in Western Australia, so that's not carried away. Now, in terms of age bands, that's quite interesting insofar that youngers 20 to 30 and 30 to 40 just are a little more frustrated and feeling the pressure than they were previously. Those 40 to 50, slight improvement. Those 50 to 60, a stronger improvement, still below the baseline of 100. And that's to do with the stock markets and the fact the stock markets have been recovering. And those 60 and above, a slight decline. And that's the index. So you can see how that's made up. The 50 to 60s is really interesting because that segment still has mortgages, but nowhere near as much mortgage. And they've got significantly more assets. So they are actually better positioned. Now, by property segment, that's quite interesting too, insofar that the property active owner occupier is up very slightly. The property active investor is down a bit, so property investing is continuing to go through the grinder here. And that's a function of rental streams being unreliable, plus the fact that now mortgage repayments are being called for from the banks. And I think we're going to see more pressure on the investment sector. And property inactive, so these are people who are renting, just fairly neutral in terms of that. But there is a big difference between owner-occupiers who are experiencing low interest rates, and many have been able to refinance, and those on investment properties. But of course, we also know that a number of people here are also struggling with regard to mortgage stress, as we've seen before. In terms of job security, one of the elements within the index, we can see that there's been a little uptick in terms of more secure jobs than recently, but we've still got a significant proportion who are feeling less secure than 12 months ago, above 65% in fact, and around 30% see no difference. So it does vary in private sector, public sector, it depends on location, all those things. So job prospects, still a very significant issue. If we then look at income, that's another very important message. Very, very small number who are saying my income has risen in real terms compared with last year. That's just a few percent. Quite a large proportion are reporting falls in income. That's partly to do with the JobKeeper, JobSeeker, partly to do with just less hours, and all of those factors are in there. And a proportion, just over 30% and slightly rising, have seen no change in their incomes. But this is a real worry, this income pressure. Remember what the Reserve Bank said, 1.8% over the last year. Many people are seeing no income growth in real terms at all. Cost of living continue to rise for many. So really, close to 100%, not quite 100%, but close to 100% saying cost of living are higher than they were a year ago. And the real CPI, of course, is significantly higher than the one that's actually reported in the official numbers. RBA, please note. Hardly anybody says cost of living have fallen, and some saying have stayed the same. So cost of living, major issue for many people. And debt remains a worry for many people too. we can see then that just a few percent are more comfortable than a year ago, whereas a considerable proportion, above 60%, are less comfortable, slightly higher this time. And that's now because more people are being encouraged to make repayments on their mortgages, whereas they had holidays previously. And about the same is sitting at around 30%. And then savings, a bit under pressure. So there is, however, some news which is quite interesting. So there is a proportion who are feeling more comfortable. Now, a lot of those are saving from the superannuation withdrawals and saving from other sources. So people have started saving more. And I showed that in the recent data relating to the savings ratios. That said, a lot of people are still feeling significantly less comfortable, dropped a little bit. And that's to do with two things. One is having no savings at all because people have dipped into them. The other is that when people have got savings, the returns they're getting on those savings are next to useless because the interest rates are so low. Term deposits are paying almost nothing. And that's a significant issue for many people. And a large number of older people who were reliant, maybe up to 3 million, who were reliant on term deposit to be able to pay the bills, is finding that they just can't make it work anymore. And we've also got a smaller proportion, about the same, and that's under 40% now. And then finally on net worth, there's little change this month actually. This is obviously taking account of the assets minus the debts. And around just under 20%, 80, 90% are higher than a year ago. And that's partly to do with some of the price moves, but more importantly to do with the stock market moves. Those who are feeling less affluent is more than 60%. That's a big deal. And there's a proportion under 20% who are feeling about the same. But this is very important. There are a number of people who are actually really up against it at the moment. And that will, of course, damp people's style in terms of being able to spend more. So if the Reserve Bank is banking on consumer consumption, my data is suggesting it may not come out the way that people expect. Now, in terms of our scenarios, as I keep saying, the scenarios just give us a bit of a flavour of what's going on. It's different to examples. And I have made no change this time around to the scenarios. So we've still got those three central scenarios, the best case, with perhaps a 5 to 15% fall in house prices, and that still has a 20% probability. My longer term crunch, which is my basically my mid case, my base case, 47.5%. of probability, and that's between 15 and 30%, but there is also a risk of a second wave disruption, which means that it could be down to 30 to 45%, 25% probability. And of course, if we really get a massive blow up, a financial crisis or whatever, then it could be even worse. But the middle road at the moment is prices between 15 and 30% from here down, and that's the one that I've been using for my one-to-one scenarios. Now, just a quick mention of the postcode tool before I just come back to the questions. We have now got the postcode tool in alpha. Thanks very much to the development team who've got this working. So this will be available in due course so that we can share information about what's going on. What I will say is that I was very grateful for the feedback that I got from a number of viewers last week, or was the week before actually, when we showed it. And so there were some observations about we'd like to see perhaps bigger text so it's easier to read. People were quite interested to be able to save a particular postcode or set of postcodes to come back to them, to be able to visit them again. And people were also intrigued as to whether they could actually get some sort of benchmark between one postcode and the whole market. So there are some examples of some of the improvements that we're looking at the moment. I can't promise they'll all be in the first release, but we are continuing to develop this. And at some point when it's ready to go, we'll then put it out for public consumption and testing and use. But it is available, and we can use this later on this evening if people want to explore some of the particular postcodes and to see the latest data, because we have number of households, the stress data and other factors are all, of course, available. So that's just another little thing that we have. Anyway, I'm just now going to go back to the main cam. And without further ado, let's go and have a look and see what the questions look like. I'm just going to go back up the page. There's a lot of stuff gone on. Goodness. Quite a few people. Okay, let's have a look. Okay. So Otto says, the government wants the young to use up all of their super to prop up the economy and to take on debt to bail out current owners. Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that. So we know that there are two things happening. We know that a lot of those super withdrawals were from younger people rather than older people. We know that quite a few people withdrew the whole of their super. And we also know that quite a few people went off then and basically spent it on, you know, goods, services, and all sorts of things, right? So that's the first point. There is also some people in the surveys that we looked at that suggest that they also, in some cases, are putting superannuation towards a deposit for a house. So that's another factor there. But the real truth is that this whole edifice of debt-driven price appreciation requires more people to come in at the bottom to support it, because it is a Ponzi scheme, it is a pyramid selling scheme, frankly. You need more people coming at the bottom to support the whole thing, right? And what that basically means is that if you don't get young people to grab their super and throw it in, or get those loan supports from the government to be able to get a 5% deposit to buy all those things, then the whole system falls apart. And we're going to see, I think, in the budget, more attempts to drag more people forward to buy property. The risk is that people will be forced to take property on at the point in the cycle when their own prospects may be rather risky, when prices are still relatively elevated, and when the forward outlook on prices is probably on the downside. And I keep reminding people that if you borrow, say you have a 10% deposit and 90% mortgage, if prices drop 10%, you lose your 10% deposit. It's not equally shared between the two. That's one of the risks with mortgages. So people need to be quite careful. And to be honest, a number of people that I've come across through my one-to-ones who are first-time buyers, they're actually really still attracted by free money from the government, you know, be it state or federal. If you're in Western Australia, you can get a homeland package, $55,000, despite the fact that homeland packages went up by $55,000 on the day that it was announced, but that's another story. What it means is that people need to be quite careful and cautious. And my own view is that those younger people are being brought in to try and support the market so that those further up the pyramid can hopefully see their properties not actually falling in significant value, because there is so much equity and so much wealth, even on paper, held by everybody in the property sector. And of course, as soon as it begins to slide, that's an issue. Now, I make the point that if you look around the world, there has been almost no example of a housing property bubble, which is what we've got, deflating just a little and then holding it still, right? Even with all the money being thrown into it. So the probability of us going through a significant fall of some sort in the medium term is quite large. And yet many people still believe property doubles every 7 years. Many people still believe the government will protect us. And many people believe that property can only ever win. I have to say that all the data that I'm seeing at the moment suggest people should be much more cautious. And frankly, prices are more likely to fall than rise. A lot of it's, of course, confidence as well. And the other thing to make the point on that, you know, markets are driven by sort of investment facts and numbers and things, but it's also confidence. And of course, the confidence issue is the most critical one. That's why I come back to my household financial confidence and also come back to the other confidence metrics that are around, because business confidence and consumer confidence are both very low at the moment. And this is before all of that stimulus gets withdrawn. So I doubt that we will see confidence levels bounding anytime soon, because essentially there is going to be less money in the system ahead. Now, Jerry says, we in Australia have very high private debt, correct? Yes, we've got some of the highest, most leveraged households in the world. On some metrics, we're the number one. So if you look at debt to income ratios, we're right up there. We are second on debt to GDP, after Switzerland. But there are some unique things about Switzerland which makes it an unusual market, particularly the international investment situation in Switzerland. So in a way, Switzerland is a bit of an aberration. But we are right up there. And New Zealand's not far behind, by the way. And with what's going on in New Zealand, probably they could overtake us, actually. But the fact is, the debt ratios are so high, there are many people still borrowing at 6, 7, 8 times income. And 2 points. The first is that ratio is extreme at the best of times. And secondly, with job prospects looking wobbly and with higher unemployment ahead, there are going to be more people who are going to be struggling. And therefore, even if the bank says, sure, you can have 6 times, some of the smart people are saying, no, I'll go for a smaller a ratio, you know, so you don't borrow as much. And I've had a number of conversations through my one-to-ones of people who said, look, the bank offered me X, but I'm going to go for a much smaller amount simply because I think that's a more realistic a way to go. And I think that's exactly right. So don't be misled simply because a lender says, sure, you can have it. They're looking after their own book. They're not necessarily looking after your book. Okay, let's have a look. Questions. Yeah, this is from Slack saying, I'm seeing six-figure salary jobs now being made redundant. Correct. This is what I've been talking about for some time, what I call structural unemployment. The first wave of unemployment was casual, part-time, fragmented jobs. And that's still, you know, washing through. There are, in some cases, some jobs coming back in that area. But now we're getting the real structural unemployment. We're seeing middle managers being squeezed out. Suncorp announced earlier in the week a considerable number of, reasonably senior people going. We're seeing it in a lot of other industries too, in consulting, in financial services, and in fact, in many other sectors too. And that's the point, really, because they are people who tend to have larger mortgages, bigger properties, bigger debt profiles, bigger lifestyles, and they're also the ones who are less likely to be able to cope if they actually get into some difficulty. And interestingly, there's quite a swathe of these as sort of 50, 55 and above, and some of those may never work again. If you go back to the last couple of crises, we saw a lot of job loss amongst very junior people, but we also saw significant loss 50 and above. And if you look back 10 years later, 50 and above never worked again, whereas those younger people did come back into the market when the market started to recover. So in a way, those people 50 plus have probably some of the highest risks, but they also have some of the biggest mortgages and some of the biggest exposures, and not all of them are risk-free, mortgage-free. And of course, the data shows that a greater proportion of people now are moving into retirement with a mortgage still to be repaid rather than actually having paid it off earlier on. That's because for a generation, people have been raiding the equity that's grown in their property and basically used the property as an ATM to be able to actually go get more money, go take a trip around the world or buy a new car and all those things, right? Now, that's fine in an accelerating market, but with prices now deaccelerating and probably falling, that's really not going to be a very successful strategy. So we're going to see, I think, this crunch at the top end. And one of the factors that I'm seeing quite often is what I call the down traders. So these are the people with a big property, with equity in the property, but now financial pressures, which means they're needing to sell. And amongst the new listings that I've seen from my surveys, it's the down traders who are the ones that are actually coming to the market and saying, I need to sell. So watch that space. I think we're going to see probably an interesting distortion in the market, because what happens with those is they tend to be bigger properties, more valuable properties. The question is, who can buy them? And if you think about the rising generations, so there'll be first-time buyers coming into the market, well, they probably won't be able to buy the down-trader properties. There'll be people in that middle group, the up-traders, and some of those may be able to buy a bigger property. But relatively speaking, there are 2-to-1 down traders to up traders. So what it means is we've got more supply at the top end coming on stream, and we've got less demand from people coming up. And interestingly, the other factor that blotted a lot of that up were investment. but now probably investors are pretty much sitting on the sidelines, as we've described earlier on. So effectively, the market has become really distorted. And I think that's a very important factor in terms of seeing what's going on ahead. All right, questions? I saw a postcode. Let's have a look. You know, one of the silly things about this particular chat facility is it sometimes jumps. So I'm, you know, looking down the page and then something goes, whee, and off it goes. 2010 postcode, somebody asked me for. All right, let's do that. Let me just get it up first. Darlinghurst, Surrey Hills, inner Sydney. All right, so this is 2010, and this was requested by Maria. So 16,000 households in the postcode, of which 3,300 are borrowing, 11,800 are renting. There are 8,900 properties for rent, and the number of rental property owners, so those are people who have investment properties who live in the postcode, but the investment property may be somewhere else, is 5,062. And there's a metric here, an overall generic metric, which is 66%, which is the total measure of financial stress in the postcode. Now, 66% is high, really high. But when you look at it, mortgage stress is quite low. It's only at 14%. So it's not a mortgage stress issue. And in fact, defaults are quite low at 2%. But what it is a rental stress issue. So here are rental stress at 56%, which is higher than the national average by a long way. But look at this. Stressed investors, 3,500, 82% are stressed. So that's 3,500 of those who are property owner, 82%. That's a huge. So what we're seeing here are property investors under the pump. And as a result of that, you can see that we actually have our three scenarios. This is my scenarios from today. Basically saying in the best case, we might see prices on average fall 7.5%, then to 11%, and then pretty much stay there. That's the best case. The worst case, if we get that next round of virus, is down 17% over 12 months, then down to 26%. And then down to 34%. And you may have noticed, if you followed this last week, that we've got the rounding sorted out on this. And this is my midpoint, 12%, 18%, 22%. And the midpoint is the one that I use when I run my specific scenarios on units and houses, because this is a generic guidance. But of course, houses and units behave differently. So there you go. That is 2010. Okay. All right. Now, this is from John John. Are the media withholding the true narrative on the property market? I feel like there is, frankly, far too many interests to keep things rosy than to tell the true story. Yeah, you're right. So first thing to say is think about the relationships between the real estate portals and the media. So, you know, Channel 9. Rather well connected to and domain, you know, realestate.com.au, News Corp. Guess what? You're going to hear a lot from news.com.au referring to all of the good news in property. And I did a show with Edwin yesterday, which if you've not watched, I do recommend it, because there was an amazing piece of information from realestate.com.au claiming that there had been 27% rises in the last 12 months in some postcodes, right? And we actually just went through them and I showed the real data. There is so much disinformation, firstly. They are trying to talk the market up. They're trying to build confidence. Remember what I said about the markets being confidence-led? They're trying to get more people to buy, to keep the market up, to make it self-fulfilling, right? The second point is that the indices, of course, are driven on very low volumes of transactions at the moment. Do you remember I said what the ABS were doing about this issue with not having enough transaction throughput? Well, everybody's got the same issue, right? So therefore, it is very hard to get really good anchored information on what's finally going on. Now, you can get settlement data. But the settlement data takes 2 to 3 months to come through because the settlement data is only actually put back into the system once settlements are complete. In New South Wales, there is actually a state site that you can go to pull information out and see property. In many other states, that doesn't exist anymore because it's all been privatized. That information is then basically gobbled up by some of the portals, and then it's filtered and you only get some of the information. The other point to make is that a lot of the portals show things like last asked price when it's sold, but last asked price is not the same as sold price. And yet, quite often, the indices are actually based off that last asked price information. So very often, the portals are overstating. So basically, you've got no transparency on what's going on the market. And I spoke to a couple of experts, both in Melbourne and Sydney recently. You can see the shows. And they basically made the point that it's impossible to know what's going on. The data out there is just not good enough. So we are really flying without compass. Then, of course, the vested interests. So there is an alignment between things like the Financial Review and the banks, right? They want to talk property markets up. Of course they do, because the Financial Review is the bank's rag, you know. And of course, that's also aligned to the government, because the government wants to try and talk the economy up, talk household consumption up. The biggest household consumption lever is housing. If you can consume and get people to consume more because they feel more wealthy, then the economy is going to get better. So all of these forces are going in the same direction. The difficulty is that the debt is very high. The truth about what's going on in property is rather different from those public statements and all that public information. And the information as presented in those authoritative portals, and of course there are a number of experts who rely on them completely and just keep quoting blandly what they're saying, I'm a little more cautious about some of that information. And I go right back to what I said earlier on about the ABS. The ABS specifically said, with such low volumes, price discovery is a problem. And I think that's worth just reflecting on. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of things that are driving property markets, frankly, away from reality. And the last point I'd make is that there is still a lot of pressure to hold an auction. Quite often the auctions are being staged because the real estate agents can charge more for an auction. And so they will try and convince vendors to go for an auction. And of course, quite often when there's an auction, the settlement price is below the asking price, but it's not disclosed. So if you look at the recent data relating to recent auctions, there are more and more not disclosed. So little market disclosure, a delayed process with regard to settlement data, and the complete absence of information in some states, and this aligned agenda between the real estate agent portals, the news agencies, the media, and the alignment then back to the government. So not surprising, it's all going on one side of the equation, as it were. There's a few of us who are trying to get a more realistic and more balanced and hopefully a more accurate view of what's going on. One of the reasons why I run the data the way I do is to try and share more information, because I think we have to find a different voice, a different way of sharing information about what's going on, so people can make better decisions. Because if you rely on the real estate agent or rely on the real estate agent portals, real estate portals, the chances are you're going to get half a story. Now, Greg says, do you think ScoMo will try and support house prices until the election in 11 months? Yes, I think they will continue to try and do stuff. Now, I've done a quick couple of calculations, right? If they wanted to keep house prices roughly where they are, I think they probably have to spend something like $850 billion. And that's a big number, right? That's pretty much all the debt we've got in Australia in the public sector. If they decided not to do that, but to support financial stability in the banks, it will be somewhere between $200 and $300 billion. And those are the numbers that the Reserve Bank has been talking about if you look at its various facilities and other things. So I think the thinking probably at the moment is we can't actually necessarily keep prices really, really high or rising higher. But we can support the financial system, and through that, we can perhaps keep a lid on how much the fall will be. I had a number of people reach out to me from various political circles asking about what other options there are with regard to the property sector at the moment. And you know, we go back to this fundamental question. We're in a bubble. This bubble has been created over a generation or two, and it's driven by very high levels of debt, very high income multiples, and all those other factors. And remember, I said if you go back 4 or 5 years, you can go and see my early shows. A little less sophisticated now, perhaps, but the message was the same, that everything's fine until it's not fine, and it's not fine at the point where unemployment starts to rise. Now, we are in the situation now where unemployment will rise probably to 10% by the end of the year, and perhaps back down to 7.5, 8% over 2 years. That is a disaster, because what it means is we're going to have some people who are going to be out of work and with mortgages they can't service. Now, the bank, of course, the banks are beginning to make those phone calls. We already know that there are some people who are being asked to put their property on the market with a view to selling before the market really gets serious about it. And as Tony LeCantre often says, if you're going to panic, panic first. That's a very important factor. The other point that's worth making is that if you look at the US and indeed the UK, after the crash in 2008, it took 3 or 4 years for this all to work through. So we started to see prices begin to slide, gently at first, more accelerating. We started to see the bad debt go up over 2 or 3 years. We started to see more people essentially not being able to repay the mortgage, and they stopped making those mortgage repayments. It got to the point where the banks were unable to do anything because there were too many of them. And I sometimes say, if you have a, you know, one or two loans go bad, it's your problem. If you have a larger number of loans, then it's the bank's problem. But if you have a lot of loans, a lot of mortgages will go wrong at the same time, then essentially it's the country's problem. And that's where I think we're going to get to. And certainly in the US, there are still people, even now, you know, even 10 years later, who are still sitting in their properties, not paying any mortgages, because the whole system basically is frozen and they can't deal with it. The other point to make is that in the US, there was a lot of property that was sold on very cheaply after the crash. And I worry that we're going to go through the same again. So effectively, property will be sold on cents for the dollar to more affluent people who can afford it. And so that's another wealth distortion mechanism that we see. Saw it in the US, saw it in the UK. I think we'll see it here too as well. But this is all going to take a long, slow grind. This is not going to be fixed in 6 months or even 12 months. And you know, on the chat before the pan, somebody was saying, hasn't it crashed yet? Well, you know, this crash is going to be a long, slow grind. The government will try and do stuff. And of course, they do have the election, you know. And it's an interesting question in my mind is whether what they're doing is saying, we really want to try and support this to get re-elected, or do they actually want to, you know, do something, but essentially hand the time bomb and the parcel to the other side and let them come in and try and clean it up for an election cycle and then come back. I don't know. I don't know which strategy they're thinking about. But I can tell you that a lot of politicians are more concerned about getting re-elected and winning than actually dealing with the fundamental economic issues that we have with regard to housing, investment in business and all those other things, which are the really big picture questions which we should in Australia be focusing on. But I fear that the budget won't do much of that. And that's a major opportunity missed, in my view. Okay. Dwayne says, can you make a comment on what you are hearing about New Zealand property? Seems crazy that sales are up, prices rising, and the economy is not healthy. Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, I've been looking at some of the data there, and we had Joe Wilkes on a few weeks ago on the live show. The fact is, of course, rates are very, very low at the moment over there. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand has basically said, we'll support the economy, we'll do whatever it takes, we'll even go to negative interest rates if that's what we need. They are using property and debt as effectively the stimulus lever, just like in Australia. They're probably being more successful at it than Australia, if I'm honest, at the moment. And of course, it's not uniform. So there are some significant movements up Auckland and also some down in some other places. So you need to go quite granular. The fact is, though, that you've got a net migration negative at the moment, if you look at the latest data in New Zealand. So where's that demand coming from? what about property investors? You know, how much more will property rise? How much more can the debt rise? And how sustainable is this? I think this is not sustainable. I think we've got precisely the same issues in New Zealand as in Australia. In a way, you've probably got even less runway because of what's happening to house prices. But it's all back to Reserve Bank New Zealand government policy. That's the problem. It's actually the wrong strategy. But it's one that will go on for quite some time. And of course, if they can support house prices and support lending and get more people to borrow, you continue to make the Ponzi scheme run for longer. And that is the agenda. And I'm afraid that it's no different really from Australia, but it's probably more overt in New Zealand. And I think we'll probably make a specific show down the track looking in detail at New Zealand. I might get Joe to come back on again, or I might get some other information. I've got a few other sources now, and I'm getting quite good information on what's happening in New Zealand. And interestingly, there was a paper that came out from Westpac in New Zealand this week, which basically said, we overestimated the falls. It's now rising again. And they actually admitted they weren't totally sure why, but, you know, they reported what was going on. So there you go. Now, Rise says, what scenarios would lead to or trigger a 9/11 of the Ponzi scheme called the housing market or collapse of the economy as a whole? Okay, so, you know, trying to sort of predict the worst case scenario is always difficult, but I can give you three things to look at. The first is, I think that there is considerable pressure in Europe because the ECB was already in difficulty before the virus hit. And we know that they're close to negative interest rates or in negative interest rate territory. We know that there's a lot of businesses in Europe who are struggling. And the banks in Europe are highly leveraged to China. So one of my scenarios is that that is where the trigger comes from. And that trigger then flows into a financial crisis, a bit like we had a decade plus ago. And as a result of that, confidence and liquidity freezes. The central banks will continue to try to print, but won't necessarily be successful. And at that point, we start seeing the negative feedback loops that everybody fears coming through. So that could be one scenario. The second scenario is what happens to China. So China, of course, has been asserting its power and authority quite recently. We've seen that in spades with its relationships to Australia. It's invested more in the business end rather than the household consumption end. And as a result of that, they have reduced the leverage ratios for the banks in China to allow them to lend more. And a number of the other statistics look, you know, quite extreme at the moment. So they may be able to keep that going. But if they don't, that could be another source. And then if you think about how that could actually be mirrored perhaps in what's happening in the US, that could be another trigger point. And the third one is, I guess we've also got to think about what would happen with the election. You know, would either side make a big difference? My own view is it's not going to make a substantive difference in the short term. It may in the longer term. But the real truth is that the central bank in the US, with Jerome Powell, has declared that they're going to allow inflation to run a little higher. I think that's more words rather than reality, frankly. And I think the reaction has been overstated around the world that somehow the Fed is now banking on inflation. And in fact, I recorded a show this morning with Steve Van Miter from the US, and it'll be coming out tomorrow, where we discuss in detail this question of inflation, deflation. You know, I keep coming back to this as one of the critical linchpin discussions, right? Because there are so many vested interests arguing for an inflationary future, but actually it's not necessarily the only future. There is a deflationary future that is worth exploring too. And so we'll be discussing that, and that show will come out tomorrow. So look at that. So what I'm saying to you is there are all these different scenarios. Now, any one of those leads us to a similar scenario, which is that liquidity dries up, the financial system freezes, and that then triggers a further set of collapses. Now, the other way this could work is that we know we've got lots of zombie companies around the world, and we know that what they've done up till this point is essentially issue bonds at very cheap rates and then buy back shares. But that is not actually real effective use of capital, and neither is a guarantee that those businesses are sustainable. And so you could actually start seeing more casualties coming through from the business area. And I think that of the, all the scenarios that I'm thinking about, the one that really concerns me the most is that you get real business failures. Those business failures cascade, that hits the stock market drops, and then of course confidence unwinds, and then we go from there. And I still think there's a reasonable chance that the markets will be considerably lower over the next few months relative to now. I can't call when. People have been saying September, October. Quite often falls do happen in September, October. It may be, may go on for longer. The unknown quantity, of course, is precisely how much more liquidity will be pumped in. The Fed will probably pump in more liquidity if it needs to, although it's actually been withdrawing just slightly compared with where it was. Next time there's a crisis, they'll throw more money back in. And of course, it'll be part of a coordinated round of in multiple central banks around the world to try and support everything. So those are some of the things I'm thinking about. As to which of those scenarios plays out, too early to say. I just keep monitoring all the information and trying to form a view. We've got enough issues locally, of course, even independently of what happens. Remember, we've still got all this international debt that we still owe. One of the issues I'm concerned about is that if the global economy wobbles further, then that's going to have a very significant impact on us locally as well. So we're very connected, we're very trade exposed, but we're also finance exposed because of the fact we borrow a lot from international sources to support our local economy. Although, as I said earlier on, the Reserve Bank is now trying to sort of cover some of that themselves, so that may actually insulate us a little bit. Final point to make is, of course, the Aussie dollar is sitting above 72, 73, much higher than it was some time ago. That's bad news in terms of importing inflation. It's also bad news in terms of results from overseas coming to Australia, and that actually could put deflationary pressure on what's happening here locally too. So another reason why inflation, deflation is an important conversation. We'll have to keep talking about this inflation, deflation, and try and sort of figure out what those leading indicators are. All I would say is that I am just not as convinced as many people that we're going to see rabid inflation anytime soon. So a question, I don't know whether this is a serious question, but let's assume it is. Peanut says, I'm thinking of purchasing an Italian restaurant in Bondi. Should I buy it now or wait? Well, depends on what you think. Have you done your cash flow? What's your uptake like in terms of customers and all of those things? What I would say is that Bondi is exhibiting significant amounts of mortgage stress, and we know that there are a number of businesses there that are in difficulty. And generally, services businesses are the ones, of course, that are being hit at the moment. But the real issue is that services businesses are actually a very large proportion of the economy, but are not actually that productive in terms of actually creating real growth. What it is doing is moving dollars around from consumers to businesses to businesses to businesses. It doesn't create a multiplying effect, right? What we haven't got in Australia is enough focus on creating value, enhancing and creating businesses. And that is where I think the focus should be. So, you know, just giving you my view as to where I think the future lies. I'm not sure that yet more restaurants is necessarily the best use of time and effort and energy at the moment. Remember, of course, that we don't know what COVID's going to do. So if COVID really starts some boiling back, and I know that Victoria is now talking about making laneways into open air restaurants and things like that, but other than New York, so that may be something else to think about too. Okay, Copper said, realestate.com.au last week announced a 100% clearance rate with 9 auction scheduled, no sold auction, 1 sold prior to auction. Yeah, I know. The numbers are nuts. That's all I can say. I cannot work out how those numbers work. Domain is somewhat similar as well. I mean, they use a particular formula with regards to reported rather than listed. So it's only on the reported numbers, and then it's what share of reported actually passed muster, right? So that's the problem. So the basis of calculation is wrong. That's why I use the SQM. The SQM data is much more powerful in my view. Okay, let's have a look. All right, so there's a lot of questions. Hoppers Crossing 3029. Another postcode, let's do that. 3029. 29. One of my favourite postcodes, this one, for the reason that it is one of those high development areas in Victoria where there is considerable issues. Here we are. So this is Hoppers Crossing, 30,708 households, 18,500 borrowing, 11,200 renting, 8,500 for rent, and 9,000 property investors in the postcode holding it somewhere. The financial stress metrics is 50%. So if you compare it with the one I showed you before, it's lower. But we've got mild stress. We've got 6,388 households in mild stress. That's 34%. There's some risk of default at 2%, but look at this. You've got the rental stress at 66% or 7,398. And you've got a small amount of investor stress. So this is about cash flow. This is about renting. And it's about people with mortgage stress. Now, 34% is not too bad. Remember that 40% is the total on average across Australia, but it's a large number. And so one of the things I always say when you look at my data here, it's worth looking at the actual number of households. So 6,000 in some difficulty. So I tend to map, when I show this, I tend to map the number rather than just the percentages, because that gives you a better feel. And if you look on my website, you can see some of the maps that I've done, including the fact that the area around this, 3029 and surrounding areas, has very high levels, very high level counts of mortgage stress, and it's been rising. Okay, let's see what else we've got. Joe says, I look forward to the video with Steve. Steve is brilliant. I tell you, we had a fantastic 35 minutes with Steve Van Meter. One of the things I'd say is do go across and subscribe to his channel. He is very clever. And very interestingly, I persuaded him to put on his Bond King crown. And so he used his various visuals for the first time as well, which is quite funny. This will be a really good video. It'll be up tomorrow. So I do recommend. And please forward it and circulate it and go and support his site. He's, I think, one of the most important independent minds with regard to what's going on at the moment. Okay, Tuan says, is there any chance that the RBA will start doing QE when things go bad, or has it already done it but they didn't announce it? Well, the Reserve Bank is talking about indirect QE, so they're basically getting the banks to buy local authority bonds, for example, which is effectively a way of putting money indirectly into the system. So they will probably do more of that. There is an interesting debate about what QE is and whether it's real or not. And in fact, Steve, who I was talking about just now, makes the point, and we discuss this in the show tomorrow, that QE really is about moving money around. It's not necessarily creating new money. And in a way, that's what the Reserve Bank is doing. What the Reserve Bank is doing is dropping rates to be really, really low, putting liquidity into the banking system to try and get the banks to lend more. The problem is there are not enough individuals and businesses who are actually willing and able to borrow at the moment. And therefore, this whole cycle of throwing more money in to get more debt to be able to drive the economy fails, not because the banks don't have money to lend, but simply because there are no borrowers or few borrowers who want to lend, want to borrow. And that's the critical issue. The Reserve Bank's QE strategy falls down at that point, in my view. Okay, Sure Sounds says 4350. Okay, this is a long list of places, but includes Toowoomba. 47,000 households, 15,000 borrowing, 23,000 renting, 17,000 with properties that are for rent, and 9,000 property investors. 40% are financial stress metrics, but look at this, mild stress, 9,600, 61%. That's very, very high. And I'd also make the point the defaults at 3% is, you know, up there. Renting stress, not too bad, 29%, but 6,000, and a bit of investor stress. So the real story here is mortgage stress, and we're seeing that with a lot of these postcodes up in Queensland, where essentially we have people who are in some financial pressure at the moment simply because of the fact that their incomes are lower. And interestingly, the central scenario is down 6.5% over the next 12 months, 13% over 2 years, and 19% over 3 years. It's a more significant fall over my worst case scenario, and the best case scenario, almost nothing. So down 1.5, down 6, and down 8.1 is my scenario for the particular postcode. So there we go. All right, now we just go across here and have a look at some of the comments here. Javier says, anyone considered if the Aussie dollar gets destroyed, what does the real estate do from an international investor point of view? Yeah, interesting question. There's a really fascinating issue here about the exchange rate. I think the exchange rate will probably still be around 72, 73 for quite some time because of what's happening with the US dollar. There is a risk at some point that we could actually see our dollar come back down. The Reserve Bank were quite like that. In fact, they hinted at it in the minutes today. What they actually said was it would be good if the exchange was low. They're sort of jawboning it, not doing anything about it, right? So my suspicion is the exchange rate won't drop dramatically. So I'm not sure that's a very believable scenario in the short term in terms of significant falls, but later, possibly. The point to make is that on an international basis, our economy is still relatively good. And there are international investors who still think Australia is a safe pair of hands relative to other economies. And because of we've got the resource base, there is always going to be some interest in what we have here. So there will always be some degree of international support for the Aussie dollar. And that's worth just thinking through. Spare Time says, can't believe people still hold Bitcoin. Gold is the real deal. Yeah, well, in an inflation environment, you're probably right. I, as you know, I'm a little bit interested in Bitcoin, but more in terms of the blockchain capabilities rather than Bitcoin itself. And there are too many uncertainties around the question of what the crypto will do. There will be some more information coming to the channel on Bitcoin. In fact, there'll be somebody coming on in a couple of cycles time talking specifically about crypto. So I'll talk more about that closer to the date. Okay. How does Teasdale 3331 look? Let's have a look at Teasdale so I can get this to work again. Yeah, it's working again now. So it must have just been a capacity error earlier on. Okay, so 3331, Teasdale. Well, I've got 3331, but I can't see it's called Teasdale, so I'm going to go through it anyway. Let's go to there. Okay, so number of households, 2,000. Number of borrowing, 1,000. I wonder whether this is the right one. Financial stress low. Mortgage stress non-existent. Rental stress at 33%. So that's enough to be a noticeable but not dramatic. Very few investors. And the mid-case, down 13%, 19%, and 22% over the next 3 years. So there you go. It's that one. Can you please check 2195? Yep, can do that. 2195. Ka-ching. Yep, that worked. Okay. Back to the PC. There you go. Okay, 8,900. This is Lakemba Wiley Park. 2,126 borrowing, 5,788 renting, 4,300 properties for rent, 47% in financial stress, mortgage stress at 29%, rental stress at 51%. So rental stress is the critical issue, but property investors, 44%. It's above the national average. So national average is 25%. So there are some property investors living in the area who have issues. And the midpoint, down 10%, down 17%, and down 21% over 1, 2, and 3 years. That's my mid case, my base case. Okay, there you go. That's that one. Okay. Please, can I do... Somebody called Beige Shirt. I like that. Thank you very much. 3690. I like your sense of humour. Hang on. Come on. Okay, 36, and zero. Okay, so that's hold on. Okay, here you go. Number of households, 14,600. Number of borrowing, 5,400. Number of renting, 7,100. Properties to rent, 5,400. Number of property rental owners, 3,800. 41% in financial stress. There's 49% in mortgage stress. There's 30% in rental stress and 29% in investor stress. So not so bad compared with the others, but mortgage stress is higher than the national average. And looking at price falls, 16.5% over 12 months mid-case, 22% over 24 months, and 25.2% over 3 years. So let's go that 12 months, 16.5%, 24 months, 22.2%, and 36 months, 25.2%. Okay, let's have a look. And you make the point there, Bayshirt, many people talking about fleeing Melbourne for the region. So, yeah, there's a bit of that. Not a lot at the moment, partly because of the lockdown. But there is some evidence of some virtual property shopping. I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens if the lockdowns are actually released. Edwin and I discussed this yesterday on our show. You can have a check it out. But we both of you agreed that it was a factor but not a significant factor. Now, Gary asks, in your opinion, moving forward, should banks continue to have the capacity to create all credit currency through the Federal Reserve banking system? No. The whole banking system, I think, has taken us down a blind alley. And in fact, banks create credit, you know, it's just an electronic entry. As long as they can find people to lend, they can go on creating more. I think we need a different approach. But we have to get from where we are to that new world in some way without breaking the system. And that's the challenge. We've got to the point where the debt's too big. People will never be able to repay it all. We know we've got over-leveraged households and businesses around the world. We've got central banks encouraging more of the same. So it actually becomes a central bank question. It also becomes a regulatory question with things like the Basel Accords and how that works. So there's a whole bunch of big picture questions. Nobody wants to touch those big picture questions. Everybody wants to sort of worry about fixing the immediate issue. The truth is that we cannot go on the way we're going on ad infinitum. There has to be a break point at some point, and it's going to either come from considered change or as a result of a major crunch. And if you ask me as to which side of that coin is going to come down first, I think we're probably going to hit the crisis first, but the crisis will be a slow grind, as I mentioned earlier on. It will be painful, slow, difficult. People will, in some cases, lose their shirts on the way through. But I can't see a way out of this without going through that painful journey, unfortunately. All right, well, we're at 9:25, so I think I've done all of those. Thanks very much for all those people who've made contributions tonight through the smart chat. That's very helpful. There's a few other questions, I'm sure. Can I do 2446? Yeah, we'll just do 2446, and I'm just going to do the last part of the presentation. 2446. Okay, so this is 2446 is places like Huntingdon, Pembroke, Toms Creek, 5,300. Households, 2,000 borrowing, 1,800 renting, 1,400 properties for rent, small number of property investors, 49% in financial stress. Mortgage stress is at 50% with just over 1,000. Rental stress is higher at 65%, so rental stress is a problem. This is just over Port Macquarie way, right? And 25% of property investors. So it's a rental stress and mortgage stress story. And the midpoint is down 11%, down 18%, and down 22% over 1, 2, and 3 years. So there you go. That's that one. All right. Let me just go back to my presentation. And just want to make a few closing remarks, and then I'll just come back for one last look at the chat. Okay. So just to say that if you want more information about what we do, The DFA blog is there. It's digitalfinanceanalytics.com/blog. You can subscribe there and get alerts to everything we do. All of our posts go up there, plus a lot of other material. You can also support us via Patreon. And Patreon is a way where you can subscribe at different levels. Just helping us with the first couple. You can actually get more content as well, going up the tiers. If you want the stress data by postcode on a monthly basis, that's available for $50 US. And the point about that is that it allows you then to play with the information in a spreadsheet each month. And we have quite a few people who've taken that. You can sign up for a month and then unsign if you just want to get it once, or if you want to take it every month, you can do that. And we also have the data. So some people actually take the full data set, including all the household results. That is available, but of course it costs a lot more. Now, just in terms of DFA one-to-one, we are still doing DFA one-to-one. We have quite a few people stacked up. We've done nearly 100 conversations over the last 6 weeks, so it's been quite busy. If you want an individual confidential discussion with me about a postcode, you can. I can't give financial advice, of course, but I can talk about the underlying trends, a bit like I've done tonight, only in more detail with more information about particular postcodes. I can assemble stress, home price, trend data, extract my pricing, trend data, and basically talk about where I think prices may go. You can book a Zoom chat. I set up to an hour. They generally don't go for that long, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes typically. Depends on, where you want to take the conversation. But I have to tell you that I'm now using a market rate. So when I started, I wasn't sure whether there'd be any interest in this. So I basically just did it to make a little hurdle to essentially deal with the fact that I didn't want 1,000 people saying they wanted it for free, right? So I've now worked out that a price of $250 is going to be my new baseline. Anybody who signed up with me already will go at the old rate, but anybody new from this point, we're going at the slightly market rate. And interestingly, of all the people I spoke with, I had at least a dozen people saying, you're doing it too cheap. This is worth a lot more than $100, which is what I charged previously. So there we go. It's now at a market rate. Still not making much, but covering my costs now, which is probably what I should have done in the first place. But I just wanted to see whether it would work or not. So the one-to-one service is still available. If you want that service, the way to ask for it is to send me a message on the DFA blog, and I'll then send you out the information. And you can contact me via the blog. Space is limited each week, simply because I got so many. And typically we're booking 3 to 5 weeks ahead at the moment. But if you are interested in a particular postcode, we can actually go into granular information and share some thoughts on that. You can make a contribution via PayPal if you'd like to help support me there. That's a pretty simple process. Or indeed Bitcoin, there's a QR code. And there's even merch. If you want a mug or if you want a sticker or something, you can actually find it there. It's also linked from the YouTube channel. And in terms of top hits this month, Edwin's Monday evening rant proving very popular. We do those each week now. Edwin is a laugh a minute, but he also makes some very important points. Tarek Brooker's last conversation from last Friday, very popular. Tarek, of course, has a really insightful view as to what's going on. I also caught up with Catherine Cashmore recently, got a view from Melbourne. Very powerful conversation that. Recommend you, if you've not read it, listened to it, you should do that. I continue with my daily updates as well. Not every day. If there's other material, then I don't do one. If there's not, I will. And the DFA Daily, of course, is effectively a summation of all the information that's currently there and sharing information and ideas. So we do some of those. So that's all available. All right. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say. Next time, the next show will be next week, 22nd of September, 8 p.m. And Chris Bates, who's a Sydney-based mortgage broker, will be with us. And you can ask him questions directly about mortgage broking, how it works, what the key questions you should be asking, all those things. And he can talk more broadly about the property market. He's the co-contributor of The Elephant in the Room. And by the way, I recorded another show for The Elephant in the Room, and that'll be out quite soon. I'll make sure that that's publicised via my socials as well. And I think that's pretty much it with regard to this evening. I'll just come back and have one last quick look and see whether there's anything else. No, I think I've got lots more questions for other postcodes, but I'm actually going to stop now because it's 9:32. If you want a particular postcode, you can just go to the blog, send me a message, and over 2 or 3 days, I can send you that one-page picture that I showed you this evening, and that is available. And just give me a bit of time because I get a lot of requests for information, but I do want to make that information available. That tool will ultimately be made available and accessible, but we've got a bit more work to do and a little bit more functionality. If you've got suggestions as to the functionality you'd like to see, continue to feed that into the conversation because it's not too late to develop more functionality around the edge of the core tool. But once it's available, I'll let you know, and you'll be the first to see it and hear it and see the future effect of it. All right. Somebody said sell DFA jumpers with postcodes. Oh, that could be complicated. Yeah. And Michael said, you're aware that Westpac doesn't accept the 10K super withdrawal as deposit for savings. Absolutely. Some of the other banks are going the same route. They are asking for proof of saving, proof of origin, all sorts of things. It's getting tight out there. And ahead, I think there's no doubt that getting a mortgage will be tougher. The loan-to-value ratios are getting squeezed. ANZ's doing that. And so basically, the Ponzi scheme is beginning to, you know, shudder and shake. Some of the wheels are dropping off. But the fact is, there are still people buying property, even now, without doing due diligence. And that's the last message I want to leave with everybody tonight. Just be careful, all right? If you are going to buy property, make sure you do the due diligence. Make sure you don't just get caught along in the spiel from the real estate agents. Do the work, do the research, get information, make good decisions. Make sure you've done some cash flow analysis to be able to prove where things are. And, you know, there is still a chance to go buy good property, particularly if you're going to live in it. Property investment, not so much at the moment. Okay, so I'm pretty much done for tonight. Thank you very much for spending the time with me. It's been a great pleasure and privilege to have you all with me on the show. We got up just below the 1,000 at peak, so that's great. Thank you very much for spending time with me. We'll see you this time next week, 8 p.m. for Chris Bates' conversation about mortgage broking. Very, very important conversation that, particularly now. And I look forward to seeing you then. Meantime, have a good evening. Keep following the show. Please share and like this and also our other shows. Please spread the word. I've been absolutely bowled over by the number of people who've basically said, thank you, thank you, thank you for what we've been doing here, because it's helped me to make better decisions. And in fact, through those one-on-one conversations, so many people have been silent followers for years. And it's great to hear that we've actually made a positive difference. So, you know, that's what this is all about. So take care, have a wonderful evening, and I'll look forward to seeing you next time. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Good night.